Well, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I love this time of the year. I moved in my wee woody in amongst the trees, and the birches are looking really bonny just now with their silver coats, and you can see them better just now. And there's a wee robin jinking about round there, round the leaves, picking up whatever. And nae that long ago, I was watching a red kite going round the top of the hill. And there's been a big far snaw recently, melting far snow, but I had over a fit of snaw here. Nae Abby's favourite part of the season, but I love it. But fam, we come to the winter solstice, we ken the licht will start changing again. It'll maybe still be cold, but then there's Christmas. So as I wander over the parks to join the gang for this episode, we can enjoy the festive soons of the Tannahill Weavers and this track for their Christmas Solstice album, the track guard, The Winter Solstice Set. I'm Frieda Morrison. Welcome to Scots Radio. Come on, guys, come on. The Tannahill Weavers for the Christmas Solstice album. What a great album that is. And we'll hear more for that album later in the programme. And gee, it was cold out there. My hands are frozen. Welcome, as I said, to Scots Radio. I'm still Frieda Morrison. And them that have been with us afore at this time will ken we I have a special bumper programme at Christmas. And the manny that shares that sense of occasion is guiding us through the wiggly waves as usual, in his B&B studio in Edinburgh, come in, Mr. Richie Warner.
Aye. I'm doing my best. How are we doing? You all right?
I'm fine. You love Christmas as well, eh?
Do you know, it's a funny thing. Like, you know, you go through the rest of the year and it's like, da 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 da, and you get to November and it's like, Christmas is coming. And then for whatever reason, December the 1st hits. And I'm like, yay, it's Christmas.
That's what I mean. And you have the tree up. Before I have my tree up, everything, the tinsel and that thing.
And
what's been happening to you at this time of the year then?
I don't know quite how it's happened, but I have a bumper Christmas with 14 people coming this year. I'm not quite sure what happened, but I have everyone. So, yes, do come and join me.
Funny that, always coming room for one more. You're going out in the streets collecting them or something?
Of course I am, yeah. Big 14. Family, what can I say?
And are you doing all the cooking for Abdi again this year?
It's me with the chef's penny on. Here we go. Yeah. As long as I get a glass of wine as well, then I'm happy. You know?
Good on you, the hill caboodle, yeah. Well, in this programme, we're at the Gathering in Edinburgh, organised by the Scots Language Group, Urvice, speaking with some of the participants and a chance to speak to MSP Emma Harper. We've got a special Gernan Christmas cracker. Christmas cracker. We have BBC Radio Scotland star, Gernan Nicholas Singleton, meeting up in my kitchen to make a Christmas wreath. What a treat! Never made you, man. Nicola is an expert. And we cannae miss it. Rain special Christmas Santa. Rain spirit of Christmas into our legs. A past vice chair of the National Trust for Scotland. And fellow Gairdner to the stars. A past curator at the Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh. Come in. Mr. David Mitchell. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Frida. Oh, how are you doing?
My lugs. What festive treats are you telling us about this party?
Well, I've just got to tell you about what all the plants in your Christmas wreath mean. And then I'm going to give you a wee bit of advice to stop your gearing for looking dreich in the winter.
Oh, that sounds great. Absolutely great. And there's special guests for this programme. Great as well. Let me welcome to your Christmas party the very multi-talented singer, songwriter, archivist, author, Fiona J. McKenzie. Fiona, glad to hear you. Atala, I've been trying to get you on this programme for ages.
Nothing cruel, Frida.
Oh, it's fine. Okay. And I'm just going to be speaking to you about your new book.
Yes, my new book. It's been a real labour of love and I'm just desperate to tell everybody about it all. The biography of Margaret Fayshaw of Cana.
Okay, The Cadence of a Song. What a super, super title that is. It's the life of Margaret Fayshaw, the American folklorist, about the love of the Hebrides and the living on the Hebridean island of Cana. That's in the Inner Hebrides, isn't it?
Yes, it's one of the small isles.
Aye. Okay, just give us a wee snippet. How would you describe Margaret?
It's difficult to put into just a few words. She was in Scots, I suppose you would call her a feisty bosom, but with a heart of gold. She had a heart of gold. And just one of the most incredible women that you could ever hope to meet, full of life right up until the day that she died when she was 101. She was full of stories.
Mm-hmm. That was in 2004, wasn't it? Near that
That's level. Right, yes, yeah.
And she married the literary scholar John Lorne Campbell.
She did indeed in 1935.
But what a life she led in him. Now, would you say that she laid an important foundation for the Gaelic revival?
Well, absolutely. I don't think that there's really anybody that could have done any more than she did. But what she did is a huge lesson for every Gaelic speaker, for every Gaelic learner in this world. You know, this American woman came to Scotland as a wee lassie, and she basically has saved the most important representation of Hebridean life in the early 20th century that exists, and nobody else has done that and nobody else can do that.
Wow.
So, I mean, what she did is incredible. But I think the lesson that Margaret has left us all is that if she can do it, a wee American lassie, if she can learn Gaelic and keep Gaelic and promote Gaelic and have Gaelic at her heart, if she can do it, then everybody can.
Good on you, Fiona. That is just such a lovely thing to say. And we'll leave it there just now because I want to hear more later. But before all that, we've got the music to get us in the mood for an album for Burnham CD featuring Aberdeenshire cellist Alice Allen. And the album is called Bass Culture. And it was Alice's contribution to the New Voices legacy at the Celtic Connections Festival, recorded live in January 2024. Live recording, folks. And this is Alice's first project, or original compositions. This is a track called Strathbogie Toast. a great track, and the audience obviously thought the same. And that recording featured a stellar lineup of musicians for Alice's performance. Fantastic. Hope to hear Mayor at this next year's Celtic Connections Festival. It's near far away, New Richie, eh?
It's not far
next
away at all.
Is there. No. Yeah. Richt, far was I? It was a packed house at the Storytelling Centre in Embra recently. Folk gathered for the annual conference hosted by Uwe Weiss, the campaigning group for the Scots language. Folk came from the Arts and Piets, Scottish Government representatives, guest speakers and listeners and performers, to talk Piet in the workshops. And here fit folk thought, though, fit has to be Dean to bring the Scots community together after the passing of the Scottish Languages Bill this year. After the hearty welcome from our Vice Chairman, Phil Reid, it was doing to business. Deputy First Minister Kate Forbes wasn't able to attend personally, but in a pre-recorded film, the First Minister left the audience in no doubt about her support for the Scottish language and the important part it will play in education in Scottish communities. In her opening address, MSP Emma Harper focused on that theme, and she referred to the Scots language as being a bridge. I asked her to elaborate on that.
So what we're what I support is using the Scots language as a bridge to help support communities. We have a lot of people that are now termed new Scots, but they are Scots learners. And so if we can help support people to speak Scots and be free to speak Scots and be encouraged to speak Scots.
But you know, how do we put that into practice? What's the nuts and bolts there?
So the nuts and bolts are about, I think, supporting whatever community is we can with funding, obviously.
Funding,
it's going to cost
yeah.
money to get boots on the ground and to get Scots speakers in about the communities. In my presentation that I just did, we spoke about funding for cultural, but funding for public. So in our National Health Service services, we already have a MRI scanner in Aberdeenshire that's a Doric-speaking MRI scanner, right?
That's right?
So this is something that we can normalise the language by showing people, whether it's on our road signs, whether it's, and I'm not saying road signs, I mean maybe street names, for instance,
aye.
Right? So I don't want to end up causing the government to have to pay loads and loads and loads to change all the signs into Scots, but we can do it in ways that are probably more subtle.
And now we're on to cost. It's mm-hmm. a very, very question that fell on the subject. And fit about the folk that say, well, look, we've got a cost of living crisis, we've mm-hmm. got a housing crisis, we've got a health crisis. How can we afford to put anything else into the development of the Scots language, even though it's legalised?
So I've just spoken to one of the researchers that said that. So I think ultimately, if we recognise Scots as a language, we support it in whatever way we can, and it can be all very like gentle, low-key, not causing millions and millions of pounds. It is if we recognise the value and importance of our own lead, we can then look at it as a way to help support other portfolios as well.
Long way we continue.
Thank you.
MSP Emma Harper. Now, the first keynote address was made by poet and screever Willie Herschel. So during the break, I managed to get some time with Willie. And since the passing of the Scottish Languages Bill marks Scots and Gaelic on a legal par with English, fits to be Dean New, Willie?
That's the big question. I think it's the hard work it's to be done now, you know, between having a kind of nominal acceptance and legal acceptance of Scots. Mm. But until that's really made into something tangible through our education system, it's going to remain just really a theoretical thing. So it's going to require support. It's going to require financial support, but it's going to require a lot of support from our educationalists and from the government to make sure that Scots is taught not just in a mandatory way, but in a systematic way.
But fit about folk outside the education system. How are poor folk going to be informed about what's happening if we're still getting confused about fit difference it marks to hate legalised?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think you've got to start somewhere. And I think the sensible thing to do is to start with the younger generation and build on that. What you're talking about is a language which has been effectively suppressed for nearly 300 years. So there's an awful lot of damage being done. And there's an awful lot of wrong perceptions that people have within the community. I grew up believing that Scots wasn't my language. I believed it belonged to an older generation. You know, that's what that was a kind of common assumption. It was your granddad and your granny that spoke Scots. They kent all the old words. And it was, as a young person, when I started to try to write poetry, I wrote poetry in English because I felt I didn't have the...
Didn't
have the authenticity, I felt, you know.
But it was a lovely bit you quoted for your new... I'm going to ask you about your new book just in a minute, but there was a lovely quote you did this morning. Mm-hmm. Fae, the beginning of your book, just the notes in your book, it says, you know, at the outset, Scots for me is a muckle cultural engine with enormous potential.
Yes, and that's what has to happen now, is to make that potential into something real and something effective. And you were asking me there about, you know, out with the education, how do you kind of go about it? And an awful lot of it is to do with self-confidence, cultural self-confidence and identity. It seemed to me that the Curriculum for Excellence was a misstep. I thought it would be far better to have a thing called a Curriculum for Scotland, where you could start teaching young people about their background, not just the kind of idealised stuff, but warts and all. And you would build on it. And, you know, if, for example, if you're teaching music, why not start with Scottish folk music? If you're teaching geography, I mean, what a country we've got for geography. History, you know.
Oh, history.
Absolutely every subject you can think of, you could start off at, you know, base level by filling in the gaps. Because what happens is people, including myself, go through the whole education system, you get stuff piecemeal, scattergun approach, you pick up stuff as you're going along, but never in a kind of coherent way. And I think Scotland is quite a different country for most countries, in the way that we don't seem to treasure our heritage, our culture, possibly because we weren't confident as to what it actually is.
You've just finished being the editor of the Scottish Language Association wonderful magazine, Cadwallons.
Thank you.
And it's just one of the best in the country. For folk that want to hear something to find out for Mary about Scots, I can recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
But you've just seen out your own book, Cad.
Ayrtons. And I'm thinking about Ayrtons as an old Scots word, and it means directions. If you ayrt somebody, it means you give them directions or you point them. Originally, an ayrton could be a point of the compass. So it was a kind of direction in a physical sense.
Aye.
But the book is more about ayrtons, about we're at a crossroads. Where are we going? Where are we headed?
Pick a poem for your book to finish us.
Okay.
And it's been half a fine catching up with you again.
No, it's great to talk to you, Frieda. Always is. And thank you very much for your help and support.
Pleasure. Over to you.
This is a poem called Unlearning.
Based on what?
It's based on a Chinese philosopher who lived in the 7th century BC called Lao Tzu, who's the attributed author of the I Ching.
Right.
And it's amazing that there's this guy who's way, way back then, how little has changed, you know. And he's full of common sense and good ideas. And, I mean, he's not really a religious guy. He's not preaching at you or telling you what to do. He's just giving you good advice about how to get on with folk. He believed that you should lead your life as if you were a plant.
As if you were a plant.
And right. People should be treated like plants and allowed to nurture in their own time and grow and come to fruition.
I'm all for it.
which means getting rid of all the kind of baggage that you get, your head full of nonsense.
I need to have that happen to me as well.
I've been going to, sitting in too many conferences and seminars and everything, you know.
My head's burning.
So what Lousy suggested, this was his advice, unlearning, get rid of it all, get all the baggage out your head, sklimming and wambling up the greasy pole, make you look the mere stour to the gowping glaikets of blaw, but being tentfu to the airtin of the wee, got you shrunkle like a moose. So tack ten of what you wail, a sooch, a mout, a pearl that flaws, mon birrow your world, heelster gowdy, call on pole doon, throw the hail trumbling universe out of tune. To make things richt, to make richt things, best let them be. And gin there's a doot, dae nocht. Learn who to unlearn. What mark should you lose that you're fit to run ocht with your head fu' of ego's fashery?
Ego's fashery. I love it.
Ego's fashery. That's what we've all got our heads steeped
ego's
with.
Ego's fashery. Follow and follow. Ego's fashery.
He's good, isn't he?
Well, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. That's great.
Oh, I better just ask. For the folk, get hold of your book.
You can get a hold of the book on the Culture Matters website. They have a bookshop. They're a publisher that are based in Newcastle, I think sponsored by the Co-op. And you can get it there, and you can get it on Amazon online.
How much?
It's £12.
Okay, a bargain.
I would say so.
Just one of my favourite folk, Willie Herschel. The wisdom of the elders comes to mind, that phrase. Just, we kind of go far away from Willie's advice. Right, so as the day grew to a close, the questions had been voiced and folk tried to work out the best way for it in the promotion of Scots language. And I spoke to our Vice Chairman, Phil Reid, and afternoon keynote speaker, Davy Donaldson. Davy is a Nakan campaigner and activist for the travelling community. First, Phil, what did he think was the purpose of the day?
That's a great question, Frieda. The day, I suppose ultimately the day is about bringing the community together and giving Abdi a platform to voice their thoughts and ideas for the future of Scots lead. This year, we've got great support for the Scottish Government for here. And it's really important that the community get an opportunity to speak directly to them, because they're the ones that will be starting to pull together the strategy for the Scots lead.
It's all about strategy. That word's been used so many times, and we're trying to get to the bottom of what it means, I suppose. And I'm going to go across to Davy. What does the strategy mean to you in your world?
Well, I think you're right. I think strategy gets bounded about a lot, and we need to start thinking about who's around the table and who's actually making the strategies and who's involved with the strategies. So I guess for me, and why today's important for me, is about how do we get communities around that table, and communities that aren't usually around the table. I think that's the key thing.
Okay, just to clarify, which is the title of your keynote address?
It's WAS Like Us, and the key thing with that for me, and when I was asked to prepare for today, it was to think about who are the Scots speakers? Who are the folk that we're speaking about? Can, when the strategy and that's there, who is the strategy actually for? And so my contribution today really asks that question. It speaks to my own lived experience as a traveller in Scotland, my own language, the cant, which intersects with Scots heavily. But the key thing that I'm looking at is how can we treat Scots and the Scots strategy as a glue to bind different communities together?
In a previous speech I heard you speaking about, that a previous conference, in fact, you spoke to the audience about language being at the heart of our heritage.
Aye, it is. I think you kind of see heritage without language, and it's through language and through the lens of language that folk navigate their own belonging with heritage. And I think that's why the Scots strategy is so important, because it empowers that. It gives folk the opportunity to reflect on the past, where folk couldn't speak Scots in the places and in the spaces that we can today because of the strategy. And I think that's that re-empowerment, that revitalisation of language, that sense of belonging actually being put at the heart of the strategy, but actually allowing the folks who have that in their hurt and in terms of how they experience their own world and their own selves, I think that's where the Scots strategy needs to really focus in. It needs to go further than preservation, and it needs to go into who are we actually empowering to speak Gus language in the future.
And the other thing is, how do we empower them? That's the kind of the nub of the whole question, that probably the heart of it we're speaking about today. Who do we get folk to have the confidence to speak Scots?
That's a really good point, Art, and I think it's getting out the message out into the communities that the language that they're speaking every day is valid, and it's very much part of our identity, but there's still a big feeling out here that it's a kind of second language thing. It was interesting, I was speaking to a Gaelic speaker recently that was fear to speak Gaelic in a business setting because they're like, I've only got kitchen Gaelic. And I was thinking, that resonated with me from a Scots side. I was thinking,
kitchen Gaelic.
Kitchen Gaelic, Gaelic of the Haim.
Aye.
And I was thinking, I've got Scots of the Haim. And I've been conditioned into thinking that's the only place you can speak it.
It's a good point. A good point.
But
congratulations, Phil, for putting this on today. It's gone really well. And mayor power to your elders, gentlemen. And I look forward to your speeches.
Thank you, Frieda.
Phil Reid and David Donaldson, what a superb combination. And the day was finished off aptly and delightfully with performances for national poet Peter Mackay and David Bleffin. Just the right ending to a really enjoyable day. And my congratulations to Phil Reid and his team at Lure Vice for a very successful and stimulating day, full of buzz, good speakers and performers, neighbouring. And here's to the next time. Right, I'm going to hand it across to some of the folk that have been listening to that. Davy Mitchell and Fiona. Fiona, what's your observations about what you've just heard from your Gaelic point of view?
Well, it was quite something actually to listen to both of the speakers, because so much of what they were saying resonated with me. Obviously now in my life now, my feet are firmly planted in the Gaelic sphere. And really have been, my whole sort of professional life has been revolved around Gaelic. But, I mean, I was brought up in the Scots tradition. I was brought up on the East Coast from Murrayshire, went to school in Fochabers, and I didn't really know anything of Gaelic until I went to university in Aberdeen and found out about this other part of Scottish life that I knew nothing about. But up until then, I had been firmly entrenched in Scots language and culture, and I still am. I still, in my singing life, I still sing a lot of Scots stuff and Burns poetry, etc. And so much there, especially what Willie was saying about language and identity, just could have been equally spoken about Gaelic there. You know, how he was saying that it was a combined thing of self-confidence and identity, and how Scots had been suppressed, you know, for so many generations.
Yeah. But how do you get that self-confidence? How do you see how the Gaelic communities have worked, raising the self-confidence? That was the magic formula.
I don't think there is a magic formula. I think, to be honest, I think it's time and geography. I mean, I have seen myself being up in the Highlands for the last 35 years, and I've seen myself a huge shift just in that short time. And that has come largely through the advent of Gaelic medium education, which I firmly believe has been such a huge part of the development and propagation of Gaelic in Scotland and in the Highlands and Islands. And my kids have all been through Gaelic medium education, and I've seen the benefits, you know, that they have garnered from having had that opportunity, you know, to do it both and now into their professional lives as well. So if we can apply that to the Scots language, then that'll be a huge
step.
Absolutely.
Dave, your observations?
Well, it was awfully interesting listening to that, Frieda, because there was two words used that really resonated with me. Yin is that language is the glue, and you've said it's a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that it made me think about is guilt.
Guilt?
There's still an awful lot of guilt about folks speaking in Scots. Folks still feel embarrassed. Mm-hmm. Whether you're old, middle-aged, or or young, you know. But the biggest thing is, we've done the easy bit. We've got the bill through Parliament. Now the hard work begins.
And it's going,
I think it's going to take two generations until that guilt is removed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you can walk into any room in this country and you can speak the way you want to speak and no feel embarrassed about it and no feel guilty and no feel different.
Yeah, you resonate with that as well, Fiona. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely, 100%. It's not going to happen overnight.
No.
But it's a fantastic step forward. A kicking off point, I think, is the thing. So.
I think that's when you were so right. There's no magic route to this. It's a gentle cultural change. It's like language itself. It has to grow. It has to evolve. It has to be part of your soul. You need to hug it, and you need to let it hug you.
Yeah.
We've got the foundation now, but there's a lot of work to do.
And I think also, I do think, and I do believe that the musical side of the culture has got a huge part to play.
Yeah.
We've seen that in Gaelic. And I mean, the Fish movement has had a huge impact as
on the
furtherance of Gaelic culture. And so if we can get a Scots Fish or whatever the word would be, I don't know what the Scots call it, but you've got but it would be. But anyway, if we can get a Scots equivalent of that, of the Gaelic Fish.
You'd be the very person to organise that, Fiona, me thinks. I'm just suggesting these things.
That's just making me think, you know, the music side is really strong. Mm-hmm. And I think poetry, obviously, but I think theatre, drama and theatre has a big role to play in this.
BBC Alba, maybe, should I suggest that? BBC Alba's played a huge, huge part in the raising the profile of Gaelic and the confidence.
Yes, totally. And it's making it accessible, you know, because BBC Alba is not just for those who speak Gaelic, but with the advent of, you know, excellent subtitling, etc. And the subject matter of the programmes, which you've seen a huge improvement in the, you know, in the variety of programming now in BBC Alba. And the programmes are genuinely of interest to all sections of the community, not just the Gaels.
I love it. Yep. And what a superb congratulations to BBC Alba. I'll put that in for the Santa's stock and just my congratulations as well. Right. Hey, listen, we need to start our Christmas programme. Christmas programme. Here we go. This is Ina, the few Christmas carols in Scots. Fiona, the best singers. This is Emily Smith with Christ Has My Hair Dyed, for her album Christmas Songs.
For us that blessed bairn was born, for us he was bathed, rent and torn, for us he was crowned with thorn. Christ has my hair dyed, Christ has my hair dyed. Shed his precious blood for us, was nailed on the rood for us, in many battles too. Christ has my hair dyed, Christ has my hair dyed. Forevermore, she bore the birth, feed us, free care. Christ has my hair dyed, Christ has my hair dyed. And were the world 10 times too wide, let our regard and stain so bright. Unworthy it were for him to bide. Christ has my hair dyed. Thank you. cradle for my spray, and I shall rock thee, Jesus, sweet, and never marry thee depart. Christ has my heart, aye, Christ has my heart, aye. We sang a sweet unto thy Lord, the knees of my heart shall I bow, and I will praise thee evermore. Christ has my heart, aye, Christ has my heart, aye, Christ has my heart, aye, Christ has my heart, aye.
Emily Smith with Christ Has My Heart Aye for her album Christmas Songs. Fabulous song. Now, folks, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our special guest, and I've been looking for it to hear her on the programme for a long, long time. She's a legend, a songwriter, a singer, an archivist, and now an author, with her own book just launched called The Cadence of a Song, about the American-born folklorist Margaret Faye Shaw, who married John Lorne Campbell again, an eminent folklorist. Fiona J. McKenzie, welcome to the programme once more, and you're so welcome, as I said.
Now,
you were an archivist on Canna, looking after the Lorne Campbell archive, and of course that of Margaret Faye Shaw for almost 9 years. Now, we'll talk about how you came there in a minute, and how you came to be that archivist, but tell us more about Margaret Faye Shaw. You touched on that earlier on.
Margaret Faye Shaw was just the most incredible personality. She came to Scotland for the first time when she was only 16 years old in 1920. She was brought up in Pittsburgh of a well-off steel-making family, but she was made an orphan quite early on, and she kind of lost her way in her life. So when she was 16, her aunts and her sisters decided to pack her off to the land of their ancestors, i.e. Scotland, and to go to school in Helensburgh for a year and see if, as they said, that the old country would sort her out. That's what they said. So she came and she went to school in Helensburgh for a year, and it was there that she first heard a Gaelic song being sung by Marjorie Kennedy Fraser, the Victorian song collector.
Yeah.
And she was just entranced by this music that she was hearing, albeit it was performed in a very Victorian, very florid, you know, kind of piano arrangement style. But she recognised immediately that there was something not quite natural about it, and she was intrigued and thought, I'm going to find out about this. So basically that was the moment when she decided to find out what this thing was called Gaelic song. And she eventually, about 12 years later, she came to live in the Hebrides full time. And having tried all the Hebrides.
Was that South Uist, though?
Yeah, she did. She tested all the islands until she found the one that felt most authentic to her. And South Uist was. It seemed to be the island that was least affected by tourism, early tourism at the time, and it was the most authentic lifestyle that she was seeing, and that's what attracted her. And so she started collecting song, learning Gaelic, collecting the stories and taking pictures. She was one of the first female photographers of the 20th century. So she was taking pictures of the people that were round about her. And the important thing to remember about Margaret is that she wasn't one of these song collectors who came for a couple of weeks and took from the community and left. She came and she stayed. She stayed with the people. She stayed in their houses. She stayed in the glen. She worked. She got her hands dirty like the rest of them. And so she stayed in South Uist for nearly 6 years. Until she met John Lorne Campbell and married him and went to live on Barra. And then 3 years later, they went to live on Canna. They bought the island of Canna in an attempt to kind of further the traditional Gaelic Hebridean farming community based around the school and the church. And that's where she spent the rest of her life, carrying on this important work, collecting and hand collecting. She didn't have any recording equipment, you've got to remember, until she met John. She was writing it all down.
So she wrote all the music down, yeah.
She did. She had classical music training. She was going to be a concert pianist when she went to the music college in New York, but she contracted rheumatoid arthritis, so had to give up that idea of being a concert pianist. But that was sad for her at the time, but it's to our benefit now, mm-hmm. because it set her on a different track in life, and she's become one of the world's most important ethnomusicologists as far as Scotland and Hebridean history is concerned.
Now, Dave was at your book launch in Edinburgh. I was snowed in at the time, so I couldn't make it. My apologies. Dave, you've heard about Margaret and you've read the book. What's your take on who she was and who this wonderful person was and a very strong character?
I think Margaret Fay Shaw was an enigma in many ways. You know, she fascinating, very strong-willed person from what I've read in about Fay's life in her own autobiography and in the other works by Berlin Press, which Fiona's book, you know, The Cadence of a Song, you know, it absolutely complements everything else. But what it does do more than anything else is it gives you a deeper insight into who she was as a person. And, I'm the more I learn about her, the more I don't know and the more I want to know. Because, I do think there was something extraordinary challenging about her, and that may be rooted in her very early life and, you know, the loss of family and what have you. And I just wanted to ask Fiona, you know, you probably know her better than anybody now, having written the book and being responsible for the archive and all the wonderful work that you did on Cana. But do you think that she came here looking for something other than the folk music? And did she find it?
Well, when she came to Scotland, she wasn't really looking for folk music. She was really looking for a home.
That's what I wanted you to say. I thought you were going to say that. She was looking for family and for home.
She was. She was looking for a place that she felt at home. She was lost with her family life in Pittsburgh. I mean, she didn't fall out with her family. She didn't have a family. No. But she just felt that there was something else out there that she was made to do. And so she was looking for that. She was looking for something else. You know, she was a little bird blown off course. That was how she described herself. Aww. A little bird.
I really sensed that in the book and the way that she was embraced by the community in South Uist. And, you know, that was reflected in the fact that where she very specifically asked to be buried.
She was buried there, yeah.
And the reason behind that was because that's where she felt most at home.
That was a family feel that she felt that you're looking for. Yeah.
So you think she, beyond all the music, you think she found peace of mind and everything here. Isn't that wonderful that someone from the other side of the world can come to Scotland and find that and at the same time give us so much back that we would have lost if she hadn't have come?
Exactly. I mean, she was fiercely proud of her American heritage.
Oh, yeah.
She was an American until the day that she died, but Scotland was her home, and this is where she felt most at home. And the reason that she wanted to be buried in South Uist, and incidentally, she's in the same grave that her friends from South Uist, Peggy and Mary McCrae, the same grave. And she said that the reason she wanted to be buried there was because that's where she was loved.
That's her family.
You know,
it's an extraordinary woman, a marvellous book, a wonderful achievement. I'm looking forward to continuing my journey through it bit by bit and discovering more about her. I did have a chuckle. I did dip through bits and pieces, and I'm not going to give the ghost away, but I did have a chuckle about her visit to the Cameron McIntosh's care home and a little quote about the way that she was able to behave there, which was wonderful. and what made her discontent, part of which was the fact that folk were too interested in watching the telly and no talking about politics. But I'll leave it at that. The rest of it's wonderful. Well done, Fiona.
But did she not insist on having a fag as well? You know,
there might have been a wee bit of naughtiness going on, you know.
Yeah. She was the only passenger ever who was allowed to smoke on the inside of a Calmac ferry.
That sums the feisty woman
that's
up.
That's it. That's the one.
And the other thing that makes me chuckle is the notice on the door about there being an attack cat lives here, and she wasn't talking about the big tabby cat, she was talking about herself.
An attack cat. Wow, I love that phrase. Listen, Fiona, how did you become an archivist?
Well, it was a long story. My degree, my second degree, was in librarianship and archive work, which I did at the then Robert Gordon's College after my first degree. And I always wanted to be in research and in library work, archive, museum work. When I got involved in the Gaelic world, Margaret's book, Folk Songs of Folklore South Uist, which she published in 1954, became my Gaelic Bible way back 35 years ago when I was starting to sing in Gaelic. And it became my working Bible for my repertoire. And I was just entranced from the first day with the picture that she gave of the Hebridean lifestyle. And I determined then, right, I'm going to work on this. So I carried on researching both Margaret and John's work throughout the years. And then I got a job with the National Theatre of Scotland in 2011 as the Gaelic artist in residence, which was a wonderful opportunity. I'm so privileged to have that. And as part of that job, they said, you know, would you like to devise a show based on anything you like? And I said, yes, of course. And I know instantly what I want to do it on. And that was on Margaret Faye Shaw. So we developed a show which was called Little Bird Blown Off Course, and Ian Vic Chanai it was in Gaelic. And as part of that two-year project, I spent a lot of time on Cana researching in the archives with the then archivist Magda Sagarzazu. Now, Magda became a very close friend of mine. I think she recognised in me somebody who had the work of the Campbells at heart and appreciated what they had done for Scotland and for the Hebrides more than just on Cana. And so she was really keen that I absorb as much as possible from her. She was from the Basque Country and just one of the most lovely people you could ever hope to meet. And she gave up basically her whole life for the work of the Campbells. She first came to Cana when she was 11 in 1962. Her father was John's best friend from the Basque Country. So Magda basically lived her whole life on Cana. And then after the residence had finished, 2014, Magda phoned me up one day and she said, in her inimitable Basque fashion, she says, Fiona, I have decided I am going to retire. It is time for me to retire. So the job will be advertised next week and you will apply. So I did.
Love it.
And I was lucky enough to get the job with the National Trust for Scotland. So we moved lock, stock and barrel, myself and my husband and two dogs, to Cana and took up residence there. Donald became the harbour master. And we had the most just wonderful almost 9 years there. And of course, I mean, I was such a privilege to have the archives, you know, at my fingertips, to develop them, to carry on the work that Magda had done. Magda sadly died in 2020, just at the beginning of COVID. But she was so supportive, you know, and yeah. I think her contribution to the work that John and Margaret has done is sometimes overlooked, you know, and it wouldn't be what we have today without the work that Magda did. I miss her terribly, but she was so generous with her knowledge and she was so keen that I basically download her brain. That's what she said. You know, Fiona, you must do this. I cannot do this. You must do this. You have the knowledge, you have the language. But she didn't speak Gaelic, so she wasn't able to understand everything that she was seeing and hearing, whereas I could bring my archive skills along with Gaelic for the first time. Really, nobody had ever done that before. And it's quite a unique kind of skill set that I had as a performer and an archivist and a Gaelic speaker, writer, etc. Yes, it was a wonderful life, not without its challenges, it has to be said.
I'm going to speak about the challenges in a wee minute. Fiona, could you please stay with us? We need to ask you more.
Yes.
Have you got the energy to speak more about this?
Yes, I do.
Now, listen, some folk may hear the sound of snoring in the background. This is not me. This is my 15-year-old dog who is fast asleep by my side. And she snores sometimes all the way through. Nicola making the wreath in the kitchen. I don't want to waken her. Sorry about that, Fiona. Anyway, but wee Bab, she's 15 in January. What an amazing little thing. Okay, stay with us. But as I said, you're a renowned singer-songwriter. And this is a fitting song for the programme, a Gaelic Christmas song called Duan Nolig. Did I pronounce that properly?
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Okay, fit does it mean?
Duan Nolig. A Duan is a song or a rhyme, and Nolig is Christmas.
Thank you. This is Fiona with Duan Nolig. Lovely song sung by our special guest, singer, songwriter, archivist and new author Fiona J. McKenzie. You're listening to Scots Radio. I'm Frieda Morrison, and with me are Richard Werner, David Mitchell and our special guest Fiona J. McKenzie. Fiona, we were talking about your new book, The Cadence of a Song, the life of folklorist American-born Margaret Faye Shaw and her life on the island of Cana, collecting Gaelic songs and stories, sharing her passion for the tradition with her husband, John Lauren Campbell. Now then, tell us about your life on Cana. What was it like?
It was a fantastic variety of scenarios, of landscape, of weather, of challenges, of delights. Cana is such a beautiful island. It's about 3 hours by boat from Mallaig, so it's quite takes planning to get there, not the least with the ferry always breaking down or the weather stopping things. The weather does. You have to get used to weather. The number of years that we got stuck on the mainland trying to get home at Christmas, I couldn't get off the island. It's a hard life. It's not an easy life. And so many people go to live on an island and think, oh, it's going to be wonderful and, you know, we're escaping from something. But if you think that way, when you move to live on an island, then you won't last long. You cannot escape from something. Everything just becomes much bigger. Your problems and challenges become much bigger when you're on a small island with a limited resources, travel options, etc. You have to be prepared to, you know, dig in and get on with it. And especially on an island like Cana, which is very limited in resources, there's nothing there. I mean, when we left just at the end of 23, there were only 16 people left. a very small community, very small, and it's difficult to grow that community because there aren't the houses on Canna. There's no spare accommodation, so it's very difficult to grow that community. Mm-hmm. So that in itself can lead to a lot of tensions, you know, for small communities everywhere. But this was a micro community, so you have to bite your tongue a lot. Mm-hmm. Which is not always easy to do, but you have to, especially when you're working as well as being a member of the community. You're actually working for the landlord, if you like. So mm-hmm. you're kind of stuck in the middle between the community and the landlord. So that's a delicate balancing act to do.
Definitely.
And during COVID as well, COVID brought lots of benefits. You know, we had the space.
Yes.
We were very lucky from that point of view. We had the space, and you know, we had the fresh air. You know, you weren't going to be in contact with people because there weren't people there. In fact, I have to say that, you know, particularly the first summer of COVID was probably one of the most lovely summers that we had on Canna because it was so quiet. We didn't have thousands of visitors normally. You know, I think Canna gets about 17,000 visitors a year, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. You know, there weren't those visitors. So you had the space, you had the headspace as well as the physical space. So mm-hmm. it was beautiful. But, you know, we had logistical challenges. You know, we couldn't get off for medical appointments. We couldn't see family. We couldn't, you know, even in the small periods when you were allowed to meet up, we couldn't because we couldn't get off the island. We had problems with getting supplies, with getting basic foodstuffs. We had issues with that. And then when food and supplies did come to the island, everything had to be cleaned. Everything had to be sterilized. We had to have strict regime at the pier. Donald was a very fierce taskmaster during COVID to keep COVID off the island.
Good for him. Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, we had a couple of vulnerable members of the community whom we had to protect. So he was very, very strict about, you know, about keeping rules at the pier. A different life.
So 9 years later, you and your husband, Donald, left Canna. Was that the opportunity to write the book?
It was. While I was on Canna, obviously I was working. When you live on an island like Canna, you don't really have much downtime. You really are working 7 days a week because you have to be prepared to deal with any eventuality. You know, there aren't, you know, any emergencies, etc. You have to deal with them. There's nobody going to do it for you. So you don't have a lot of time. So although when I was working in the archives and I was doing the research and collecting all the wee snippets of information that mm-hmm. nobody had seen before or heard before, I didn't have time. I didn't have the physical time to be able to sit down and put my headspace into a place where I mm-hmm. could write a whole book. I didn't even know if I could write a whole book then. So it was only really when I left Canna that I was able to put my head into the right place to be able to write a book. And it was a very cathartic process too, because you know, we didn't want to leave Canna at all. So it was a very cathartic process going through the writing of it and helping me to almost grieve for the loss of a life that we loved. And I think that it was a very special process to go through and to have the opportunity to write the book and to find that I could actually do it. I could do it after being encouraged by Magda for so many years and thinking, I can't do this. I can't do this. But actually finding that I did. And once I got started, I couldn't stop. That was the thing. You know, it was just
good for you.
Pouring out.
Okay. As I said, you're a renowned singer. By the way, did I hear a dog boofing there?
You did.
This program's been taken over by dogs. It's not even both in dogs.
Yes.
This is not scripted, but you told me earlier a lovely Christmas story. You've got a rescue dog, haven't you?
I do, yes, I do. We have two dogs. We have Marak, who's a border collie. He's 5. But we also have a wee Romanian chappie who's only been with us for 3 months. He's called Brock because he looks like a badger. Mm-hmm. He was supposed to be a collie. That we were told we're getting a collie. But when he came, he's like a short-legged, dachshund-type collie. And he's a very determined little cat.
a lovely, lovely story for Christmas. I rescued a Christmas puppy. Okay, as I said, you're a renowned singer. Now, what's the plan for next year? And I heard a whisper. Budgies have been speaking. We've got a plan for next year. Edinburgh Festival?
Oh, well, yes. We're hoping that we can maybe get a spot to do a project which I've been developing with Greenock-based singer-songwriter Yvonne Lyon.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a great friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And we've been working on this a show, which is it's not about Margaret, but it's based on the premise of the work that she did, which is about passing culture on and how when you pass it on, it grows. So it's based around a flame, and we're using Margaret as being the flame, and she passed the culture on and it grows as it gets passed from person to person. So we've been working on the show for the last couple of years, and it's ready to go. So we're hoping that we might get a wee spot at the Edinburgh Festival. Oh. So if anybody's listening and anybody would like to take us on.
I will be there. I would love that. I would just love. Fiona, thank you for being with us, and please stay with us as we explore some of the delights of the festive season through the skills and wisdom of two of my favourite gardeners. It's just been folk will want to know where to get the book, and just gives an idea where, how, what, how much, and the title again, please.
The title is The Cadence of a Song, which is it's a line taken from a poem by one of Margaret's closest friends.
A great title.
Kathleen Rain. So it fits Margaret perfectly, and it's been published by Berlin in Edinburgh. So mm-hmm. you can get it on the Berlin website, which is berlin.co.uk, or I think it is on Amazon as well. Mm-hmm. In fact, it'll be in every good bookstore, as they say. I think the recommended retail price is £25. I think you might get it a wee bit cheaper maybe on Amazon, but it's pretty much in all the bookshops.
Great, 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 great Christmas present. Great Christmas present. Yes. Now, to another of your songs, Fitting Again, I'll let you do the introduction to Talig Criesta.
That was pretty good there, Frieda.
I'm getting better. Better.
Talig Criesta, a talig is a lullaby. So this is the Christ Child's lullaby. And this is a traditional Hebridean, South Uist and Eriski Christmas hymn. And it was collected by Margaret on Christmas Eve in 1929 when she went to Mass in Eriski. Mm-hmm. And she collected this, she heard this and she noted it down, and so she published it in Folk Songs and Folklore of South Uist. It originally was collected by Father Alan MacDonald, who was a priest on Eriski, and he kept it, and it was performed. It's performed still at every midnight on Christmas Eve in the church in Eriski and in Dalabra in South Uist, and is one of the most traditional of all Gaelic hymns, and it's very easy for people to pick it up, because in the chorus there is only one word, and that's Alleluia.
Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia.
That was absolutely beautiful. Just spellbinding. Thank you, Fiona. That was Calig Criesta, sung by my guest, Fiona J. McKenzie. And you just cannot get better than that. And just the sound of your voice with the backing and the fact that it's come from the heritage that you were describing just makes that song very, very special, Fiona.
Well, it's helped I having the sublime voice of my ex-boss, James Graham, also a MOD Gold medalist there to support me there.
Fantastic. Now, just off the piste a little bit, are you a gardener amongst all your other talents?
I'm a very bad gardener in that I'm willing to get my hands dirty, but I don't really know what I'm doing.
Okay. Richie and me try to live up to the very talented Mr. David Mitchell.
Oh, aye.
He does not let us off for anything. Richie, you cleaned your mower yet?
Well, I've got a confession to make. I think I've only cut the grass like 3 times this year or something.
That's me. No.
You're a skillum.
See? He says, no, you've got to clean it. How do we have time to clean our mowers and our blades?
No,
you know?
Question
have you
this?
Cleaned your mower? No. I'll say no.
I'll get up with you, Pierre.
And Richie, have you planted anything this year? No, just give
me I've not, but I'll tell you something. We did actually buy a monkey puzzle tree from the Botanics in Edinburgh quite recently, a little babby one. So I think a monkey puzzle tree will be going in next spring somewhere. The old Araucaria.
See?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, but move on quickly before he gives us another row. The guerdon, to me, is a big part of Christmas. Just the colours and the frost hanging through the branches. There's just something about it. It feels Christmassy. And this year, I'm making my own Christmas wreath. Richie, my own Christmas wreath.
I don't believe it. Amazing. Ever creative, Frida.
I'm making it. It's going to be a mess.
Come on.
Yeah. Nicholas Singleton, gardener to the stars, is going to be giving me a lesson. How to make my own wreath. She's good. Oh, Nicola is the biz. But before that, no. David Mitchell of the Elk is going to tell us about the history of the Christmas wreath, a special delve. Okay, what is the origin of the traditional Christmas wreath, Mr. David Mitchell?
Well, Frida, there's an awful long story about this, but we're going to cut it short, and we're just going to say right away it's steeped in the legacy of ancient Greece and Rome. And it's kind of tied in with things like the Yule log. You know, these ancient cultures affected the pagan cultures in Northern Europe. I mean, in Greece and Rome, wreaths were made out of olive branches and laurel and oak, and they were used as a headdress. In Northern Europe, in Scandinavia and other parts, wreaths were made out of evergreens and they were circular. And they were seen to sort of represent the sun, as it were, and they were brought out at the winter solstice, representing the changing of the seasons, the turning of the year. And then as Christianity spread through Europe, the Christian church adopted these pagan festivals and, you know, built them into the cycle of the religious year. So the wreath then became seen as a sort of symbol of everlasting life and love, a symbol of resilience and strength and hope. And, you know, today in Britain, wreaths are commonplace on doors, and that goes back to the Victorian era and the influence of the arrival of Queen Victoria's husband, Prince Albert, from Germany. That also brought the Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. But again, when I was a young lad, you didn't really see wreaths on doors in Scotland. You know, 50, 60 years ago, they were an unusual thing. But now, it's commonplace. They've been adopted. So when you look at a wreath on the door, it's linked to ancient Rome, Scandinavia, the Victorians, and, of course, yourselves, you know.
I like holly and ivy, but holly especially. Do they have a cultural meaning or are they just bonny thingies?
Well, you know, holly was used as by the Romans. It was seen linked to the festival of Saturnella, which was celebrated on the 17th of December by the Romans. And it was also thought to be sacred to the Druids. And it was thought to provide protection for witchcraft. That's why holly bushes were often planted in churches, churchyards and roundabout houses. Mm-hmm. And because it had reed berries and it was jaggy, it was said to represent the crown of thorns in the blood of Christ. But my grandparents wouldn't have had holly in the house before Christmas Eve. He wouldn't have dared bring it in before Christmas Eve. You know, so, you know, this whole thing about bringing it in early, that kind of goes back. Ivy you mentioned. Now, ivy's an interesting plant. That's originally dedicated to Osiris, the goddess of motherhood in Egypt. But again, in Greek and Roman culture, it's associated with own rascal Dionysus, or Bacchus, the god of wine. And it's also associated with the Greek god of marriage. So it was, you know, ivy has, that's why you still find it in bridal wreaths. It's quite interesting. So maybe when you see it in a wreath, it's something to do with reaffirming our relationship with Christ and reaffirming our relationship with, you know, the cycle of the Christian calendar, the cycle of the year. And then, you know, I think the other thing that you don't see in wreaths as often but has a lot of ancient meaning is mistletoe. And, you know, mistletoe, like holly and ivy, it's connected to pagan beliefs and Druidic ceremonies. It was said to wave off evil spirits. It was thought to have the ability to heal. But in Norse mythology, it was linked to Bladner, the best and brightest of the Norse gods. It was seen as a sign of love and friendship. And that led to the custom of kissing underneath it. So when you get into a house today, aye, this Christmas, only Christmas, just look above you as you get underneath the door. Or when you're standing in the hall, because there might be somebody there wanting to steal
snoggers.
A kiss off you.
Snoggers.
Aye, snoggers keep an eye for the snoggers. Watch them.
It's Viscum something or other, I can't imagine. Viscum fit, mistletoe. Viscum. Viscum.
Viscum album. And it's a parasite. It's a parasitic plant. Uh-huh. But that's a story for another day.
Okay, another day. Right. I suppose you've got favourite decorations for Christmas in real
Well, you know what? I look back on my life, Frieda, and I've made a wreath every Christmas since I bought this house, and that's over 30 years. And I wish I'd photographed them all in some ways, and in other ways I didn't, because I've got the memories. But they change every year. I like the blue spruce, Picea pungens costeri, and I like green and variegated holly. You know, I usually make a foundation of green or variegated holly, and then I put spruce round the outside. I like to put a wee bit of flash of golden yew round about it. Kind of makes it big and bright and look like the sun, and that's its ancient past. Some years I'll put reed bells on it, or golden bells, or wee brightly coloured parcel ornaments. And other years I just think, nah, I'm going all natural, and I'll put the seeds of iris foetidissima on it. They're bright orange, or rose hips. Or sometimes I'll make wee bundles of cinnamon sticks and nutmeg tied up in tartan ribbon. Oh, and I've always pine cones. They're right on it.
Pine cones.
There we go. Aye, I've seen me put acorns.
Aye.
And, if I'm going avant-garde, you can, I'll put eucalyptus and teasel heads on it. To be honest, it doesn't matter what you put on it.
It just looks bonny.
Just make it look bonny, whether it's holly, spruce, pine, contemporary plants. Just mark it and enjoy it. Take a minute to think about what it means.
Okay.
It represents the sun and the cycle of the year.
On that note, you will be so impressed with what Nicola Singleton did in my kitchen with her wreath. And I helped. I didn't hinder. She has patience and understanding of my inability to do anything remotely creative in a craft. But she helped a lot. Now, Mr. David, you know as well as I do that it wouldn't be Christmas without Annie Lennox. I ken it's a bit of a tradition.
I tell you, Richie, I saw the script and I got to page 7 and I thought, oh, it's no there. And there it was.
There it was, Annie Lennox. And Fiona, I am a big fan of Annie Lennox, I have to say. But have you heard her Christmas Cornucopia album?
Maybe a few years ago, maybe.
Aye. Well, it's just a classic. This is Annie then. Angels for the Realms of Glory.
Angels from the realms of glory, wing your flight through all the earth. He who sang creation's story, now proclaim Messiah's birth. Gloria in excelsis Deo. Gloria in excelsis Deo.
just is Christmas. I've started in the Christmas spirit, the whole thing. Listen to that production, Annie Lennox with Angels Through the Realms of Glory. So now we came there about the Christmas wreath, thanks to David Mitchell, but food of we muckled in. Now I have tried in the past without success. Well, they just fell apart. Say no more. But help is at hand. Nicola Singleton is in a yon folk that just kens footy things. And she's patient, encouraging and understanding about folk that havena got a natural knack of doing some things. Please listen very carefully, Richard Werner and Dave Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
She's got patience and is encouraging. She's also in the country's best loved girders, appearing ilka week on BBC Radio Scotland on the Friday programme with Stephen Jardine. So I was delighted that Nicola agreed to do a visit to my ain garden. Nae a lot to see fun. She arrived, mind you, but we just had a big fast now. So Athing was covered. Maybe a good job, mind you. Athing was just covered. Richie, a good job, yep. So we got down to the macken of the Christmas wreath. Couldn't I get into the greenhouse, door frozen. So into the warm kitchen we did. Okay. Kitchen, here we come. And dogs and worms. We've got everything in here. Right.
It's cosier in here, Frieda.
it is a different environment, isn't it? Yeah. Right, Nicola. Let's get everything sorted out on the table.
Okay.
Because you've come prepared.
What I've got here is basically your kind of ordinary, plain straw. And it's covered in artificial moss. This is the wreath ring.
Uh-huh.
So it's just a plain ring and it's about 35 centimetres.
Did you make that?
No, you can buy them.
Oh.
But people used to, I mean, you can buy the metal ring and put your own stuff on it, like straw or moss, but moss, you can't take moss from, you could take it out your own garden, but yeah. You can't take moss from the countryside because it's not allowed.
Good point.
So we've got to think about environment. Okay. So, but this is fake moss that's on it. And you don't even see this. Once you've made the wreath, you don't even see it.
So then you've got...
stages. So I've got my ring. And then I've got my beautiful noble fir. This is gorgeous.
You like your noble fir.
It's really stiff, straight branches with a lovely little pine needles all facing the right way. The good thing about this kind of conifer on the wreath is that it's quite, you know, it stays flat.
Aye.
And it doesn't hang down. So it stays rigid.
Okay.
So I'm just going to... chop some of these in, what would you call them? They're about 30 centimetres long.
Uh-huh.
So they're like big sprigs. And the big sprigs, I'm then taking a roll of, it's like florist wire on a roll. And you just tie it off. Like, you know, when you do your sewing, you do a couple of stitches to,
uh-huh.
You tuck your wire in. And then you get your lovely bits of noble fir. And you lay them flat onto the ring. And then you just wrap your bits of conifer all the way around the ring.
Aye.
So you've got a lovely ring just covered in noble fir. But you can use spruce.
Right.
So we've gone all the way round and...
it's 16 minutes to do that.
Yep, doesn't take
long.
It would
take me half a day to do that.
And then when I get to the end, so my whole wreath is completely covered with a nice conifer.
Aye.
And it's quite flat. I'm just tying off my wire, so I'm just twisting it round in itself.
Aye.
I'm not using my scissors to snip. I'm using my little wire snippers to cut the wire so that I don't spoil my scissors. Okay, don't cut wire with scissors.
Don't cut wire with scissors.
You've got a nice ring. So you do the same with your holly. So
you basically
get your holly and snip it into smaller pieces. So I've just cut this off the tree. Right. I've got some variegated and I've got some green, but I've actually got a variegated holly, so that's a really nice one to have access to.
Is that hedgehog holly?
I don't think it's the hedgehog variety, but it's similar. It's slightly bigger.
I love hedgehog holly.
Is much more, it's a bit smaller. So the holly bit takes a bit longer.
All right.
So what you have to do is you go round and round and round the wreath.
Okay.
With your holly.
So then we have the berries, the red berries.
So once you've done that, you've got your conifer, you've got your holly, and then the berries are, the berries are great this year. Look at these holly berries.
What kind are they?
This is just red holly berries,
you still have the holly berries?
It's a non-jaggy holly, which is even better. Straw.
Is there a dog snoring somewhere?
In the background?
Yeah, can you hear that?
It's a cosy kitchen.
It's a cosy kitchen.
Got to have a dog.
Try your mouth to hear. Decent recording.
Oh, she's stopped now.
I've woken her up.
She's stopped now. So I'm just attaching my berries. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do 3 clumps of berries on this one.
Okay.
And then I'm going to get my beautifully foraged Scots pine cones. So any sort of cone that you can get a hold of.
Yeah.
Then that'll
pop
do.
Pop it in. And any kind of bobble, lovely red,
yes,
golden, yep, bobbles.
If you want bobbles in it, you can put bobbles in it. If you want...
But you've even got cinnamon sticks in there.
Yes, cinnamon sticks are lovely.
Cinnamon sticks.
Yeah, have a sniff of that. They smell gorgeous.
I love cinnamon sticks. Yeah.
And I've got some, if you want a ribbon, so I'm just unrolling.
Yeah.
This is florist ribbon, so it's quite wide. I'm just tying it in the back.
Have you noticed how easy you make everything look? Or am I the only person that's going to notice that? I can just imagine what's going to happen when we start this. I'm going to have a go at it later.
I'll time you, Frida.
Oh. That is brilliant.
And I've just cut a wee V
end of the bow.
And then my bow will get tied on at top or bottom of the wreath.
You're brilliant. Nicola, I can't thank you enough. I'm going to have a go at it. And you can well imagine the mess I'm going to make. So I'll make you a cup of tea, a vanille, so that you can sit and watch for what I'm going to do.
Is it going to take a while?
It could take a long time. For the time you hit leave.
Well, before midnight.
Okay. Right, cup of tea time. Right.
Fab.
Dog stops snoring now as well. Be babs. Okay. Thank you. Kettle on. Nicola Singleton, wreath making. What a treat that was. And I did have a go. I did try it. And within not long, it all fell apart. Fell off. All my berries fell off and everything. So I'm going to try again when nobody's looking. This is another track from the Christmas album by the Tannehill Weavers. Album card Winter Solstice. Track card The Reflection. Thank you. The Reflection for the Tannehill Weavers, and that's for their Winter Solstice album. It's a great album. Mr. Mitchell, I'm going to come back to you again, because before we go and get writing our letters to Santa, what plants would you recommend for the winter garden? Just very briefly, something for the birds and for the colour.
Oh, Frida, there's lots of things that you can recommend. My Bible for winter garden is still Colour in the Winter Garden by Graeme Stuart Thomas. In fact, you know, if you garden, my gardening year starts at the end of October and it finishes in May. Because if you get colour at that time of year, the rest of the year looks after itself. But Christmas Rose, Helleborus niger, that's got to be a must. There's other hellebores you could use. Hamamelis mollis pallida, beautiful chrome yellow flowers, wonderful smell like lemons. Viburnum farrarii, it's in full flower out my window now. White and pink, very sweet scent. The little winter flowering heaths, you know, Erica carnea, Fox Hollow, Pink Spangles, Garia elliptica. There's a rhododendron Christmas cheer. That eye does its thing. Silver birches, you mentioned. You get the coloured stems of things like dogwoods, you know, Cornus alba sibirica and Flavorima, reds, yellows, greens. Putting these things where the sun strikes them is very important.
Mm-hmm.
You need a big garden to have holly. But if I had to choose one holly, I would choose Ilex Golden King, because it's no jaggy, it's got buttery yellow leaves, and it produces an abundance of fruit. Hedra Helix Glacier, Gold Child. And my absolutely, if I had to choose one thing, one thing, it would be Daphne Blois Jacqueline Postel. Sweetly scented, white flowers, in a sheltered spot. Oh, man. That thing is beautiful fragrance. It's no cheap to buy, to buy, but it's worth it.
Thank you, Mr. Dave. That was just fantastic. As usual, you just go into nooks and crannies we didn't think about. And that brings us to the end of this Christmas bumper edition. As is tradition, as we are primed with a compulsory wee sherry. The sherry glass is ready to toast Abdi for our the support. And we take this opportunity to wish you a Christmas of your choice. Be it merry and bright or whatever, for your Yuletide. We leave you with a Christmas reading for Mary Blance in Shetland. It is my favourite. And music for Ali Levac and the Woodlands Drive music. For Richie Werner, special guest Fiona J. McKenzie. Fiona, thank you so much. Have you enjoyed yourself?
Oh, I've just had a blast. More than time.
Kenneth, you'll need to come back. You just... Oh, it was lovely hearing about that thing, and especially, of course, your new book and your songs. Goodness me, we need more songs for you. Okay. To Nicola Singleton for the special appearance, and for myself, Frieda Morrison, and for Richie Werner, Dave Mitchell, bide weel and warm and enjoy your space and mine. We're nae far awa'. So, are you ready, folks, for the customary toast? Get your glass ready. Are you ready? Ready? After 1, 2, 3. Ready? One. It's Blythe Yule, by the way. Blythe Yule, by the way, if you're ever going to tell you. Ready? What would you say? Blythe Yule or what?
Nollag Creel.
Okay, you can say that as well. Are you ready? 1, 2, 3. Blythe Yule!
Blythe Yule!
The night that Christ was born. Alas, was gan to cry, to Bethlehem cam, weary and makin main. And fand they were nae wy to lay her doon, for a' the beds was ta'en. The lodging mistress said the buyer would hit a didum till the morn. There, twa clean windlings spread athin an empty stall, God's bairn was born. A pity whig wi' a star athin her brew was tied upon the wark, and in by at the barn, we sleepy peasters, hens upon the back. When a' was o'er and done, the midder's een drooped in sweet relief. Joseph sat, wondering on this marvel, it was nearly past belief. Then suddenly, the lift was filled with light and singing fae aboon, as pretty dancers shift, same of the singers at a heavenly tune. And when they a' were gane, doon the lang hallie gate the shepherds came, wondering what it might mean, and Ian was carrying a tongue of lamb. They came in trow and bent afore the infant in a glood of light. Into themselves, without a doubt they kent, hundreds of years would hear about this night. The night that Christ was born, by Stella Sutherland. Thank you.